Will. Mr. Will Arbery is on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
You're just diving right in.
We're diving right in, man. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you coming on, man.
Yeah, of course. You know, thank you for having me.
And I'm always excited when we have a playwright come on. I find playwrights to be completely fascinating. I find your guys' minds to work on a completely different... I feel like you guys are on a completely different wavelength. And it's always wonderful to just sit down and chop it up with you guys. I know you recently moved to L.A. Did you move out there for work? Obviously working on... Was it because of... I know you're working on Succession. Was that something that the reason you moved out there?
No, it was entirely a kind of lifestyle decision, or just, you know, just wanted more space.
Yeah, you were in New York for quite a while.
Yeah, I was here for 12 years. I lived in like 8 different apartments when I was here. You know,
Jesus.
Yeah, I was just a little worn down. I was ready for something new. Yeah.
Yeah. People that live here for a long time always move there. And then people that move there for a long time always move here.
Yeah.
I lived there for a long time and then I ended up moving here.
Yeah.
So it's always different.
Yeah. I'll be back all the time. I'll probably, you know,
yeah,
probably die here.
We need you here, obviously. But yeah, I'd like to get into just, you know, where you grew up in Texas. How was that growing up in Texas? How did that affect, how did you get into even playwriting?
Growing up in Texas was fine, you know. it was life. I think I knew from a young age that like it wasn't, you know, that it probably wasn't going to be where I stuck around. I used to have dreams of just falling down into New York from the sky, even when I was a kid, because I just even though I'd never been there, because I just felt drawn. I think through movies and stuff, I just felt drawn to New York and felt like I was gonna be here at some point. And you know, it was Bush era Texas. It was Dallas, so I went to an all boys Catholic school. It was very, you know, it was very Republican and, you know, pro war. You know, it was. Yeah. I just felt that, like, from a young age, I felt sort of, oh, this isn't my place. You know, but I got through it. And, you know, I had some good teachers and they really inspired me to pursue writing. And then I was also acting a lot when I was in high school. And then, I come from a very like Catholic conservative family, and I decided not to go to a Catholic college, which I have 7 sisters, and, you know, they had all gone to Catholic colleges, and I decided to go to, Kenyon College in Ohio.
Right.
And so then that was sort of like the beginning of my escape in a way. And then, yeah, and then I just kept acting. I was directing a lot of plays. I was doing improv. I was like writing a ton. And then eventually my junior year of college, I took a playwriting class with the playwright Wendy McLeod. And it just felt like all of my interests that had been sort of like, you know, I had been pursuing passionately and simultaneously just kind of clicked into this one style, this one medium. And I really, it's like I felt it in my body, just like, oh, this is, it's all been leading up to this. And I just had a real knack for it and was just genuinely so exhilarated by the act of writing plays. And so and so then it was like, okay, let's focus on this and see what happens.
And then you went to Northwestern.
Yeah, I had 2 years here in New York that were just sort of, you know, it was just
experimental, coming to New York, see what happens.
Yeah, and just, yeah, like a suffering that I'd never known was possible.
Why?
Just,
what was so
well,
bad?
Just mentally, I mean, I didn't have any money. I had no idea what I was doing. I had no connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had read the plays that they gave us in class, but, you know, I didn't really know. You know, I didn't know what an agent was or did. I didn't know what a literary manager was. I had no sort of strategies for how to go about pursuing this thing. And all I really knew how to do was like make stuff that I knew how to do. And so I just was making stuff with my friends, and we were doing like devised theater pieces, and I was writing plays, and they always had this intensely collaborative element, and we were just putting them up wherever we could. And it was just this real hustle, but like, we didn't really know how to market it. We, you know, so we made some awesome stuff that nobody ever really saw. And I was broke, and I was, you know, like eating too many crab rangoons and drinking too many 40s and going a little bit insane, like truly, yeah. like mentally was not, like, you know, it was a whole new world. So
yeah. Did you ever think about moving back during that time, going back home?
Yeah, totally. I thought about it for sure. And just like the encouragement of one older sister in particular who was living in Dallas and sort of also a very artistic soul, mm-hmm. and was like, you just gotta stick it out, you know, just stay there.
Yeah.
So her encouragement was really important to me. And yeah, and then eventually I made my way to Northwestern. But it was a real time of kind of flying by the seat of my pants and just, yeah.
The reason to move to New York at that specific time was, I'm going to go there and I'm going to write and I'm going to make it as a writer. Was that the intention? And then you quickly found out, well, I don't know anybody. I don't really know what's going on. Is that what happened? Or
it was like, you know, three or four of my best friends were moving there. So I was like, I guess I should do that too.
Yeah.
And also some older, very good friends who are like a couple years older than me at Kenyon had started a theater company where they were doing this devised work. So they were actually already making some stuff. And I was like, okay, I want to go be part of that. You know, yeah. at least there's people I can dive into stuff with. But even the playwriting, even though I was like, yeah, I was writing a lot of plays, mm-hmm. or, you know, and I was like submitting to short play festivals and all the stuff that you do in your early 20s when you're trying to be a playwright, I still didn't know exactly, you know, hadn't really conceptualized that was a thing that I could really do with my life. So it took like eventually meeting a lot of people and like doing an internship at New Dramatists and, you know, like meeting a peer who was a little bit older than me, and I said that I want to be a playwright, and he was like, no, Will, you have to start saying you are a playwright. And I was like, whoa, you know, I started doing that, and it was really helpful, you know, and and I just started piecing it all together in a very like backwards fashion.
It's incredible how much a tiny piece of encouragement along the way, every step of the way, you know, people, I get asked all the time, you know, why, you know, what keeps you wanting to keep trying to keep going? And I'll just remember like maybe one day in a class when I did a good scene and somebody will come up to me and be like, that was really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll just carry that.
Yeah.
And you'll hold on to that for like the next 6 months. And that'll be the reason that you keep going. It'll just be those little wins, you know, those little tiny moments of encouragement, that because it's hard to keep going,
definitely,
you know, especially in this business when there's not a lot of you know, if you're not booking a lot, if you're not working a lot, you know, it takes a little bit of that. You brought up your sisters. You have seven sisters, which is quite amazing. How was it like being the only boy growing up in a household you know, with seven sisters? Only one other person was creative or
no, I mean, it definitely like runs in our blood in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, my dad's a poet and a novelist, and I mean, my parents are both teachers, but he is an avid writer and reader, and and my mom is also very gifted with language, and, you know, yeah, pretty much, yeah, everyone in my family is a very gifted writer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have a sister who's also a gifted, you know, sculptor and you know, photographer, and sisters who were great actors and, mm-hmm. you know, were always the leads in plays in college and stuff. And so it really runs in our blood, but I was the only one who really just like pursued it strongly right out the gate. I mean, I have 25 nieces and nephews, if that tells you anything.
Wow. Yeah. Holy cow, that's incredible.
And counting. So, you know, like it's...
nice.
There's, you know, it's... The Catholicism was a real thing, you know? And I don't think that it's just a coincidence that I'm the only boy and was allowed to go off and do what I'm doing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So it's complicated. Well, but like from a personal standpoint, growing up in that environment was the best thing that ever happened to me. And, you know, especially being on the younger end of it, I'm the second to youngest. And, you know, it made me very, at the very least, very like perceptive and very in tune with people's emotions. And, mm-hmm. And I think, you know, all of that is a big reason why I do what I do.
And how did it, well, the, speaking of Catholicism, it's a very big theme in a lot of your plays. How does your family feel about you writing about that sort of stuff? Also, your family itself is very intertwined, and a lot of the characters are based on some of your sisters. I'd like to get into Plano because I feel like maybe there's some other stuff in their family wise that are that influence some of the characters, and there might be influence and stuff. But do they mind that you're using these sort of themes, or even, you know, referencing them in plays, or how do they feel about that?
It depends on the person. Yeah, there's like, so, you know, some sisters who are super cool with it. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom, who I kind of put through the ringer in the plays in a lot of ways, like, yep, she's weirdly cool with it. Like,
nice. That's, know, awesome.
Yeah, and then there's some other conversations that have had to happen that were difficult, and but things feel like they're in a good place now. It's just a weird transition to go from writing in obscurity, mm-hmm, you know, trying to become a better writer, and therefore using eventually more and more of the things you really know, the real, you know, material of your life, mm-hmm, and then have increased exposure because the writing's getting better, because it's more honest, because it's about the real stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I was just, you know, I was in this, you know, place for like 7 or 8 years where nobody was ever reading anything, mm-hmm, I was writing. No one was writing about the things I was writing about, you know, mm-hmm, and suddenly with Plano, it was getting written about in the New York Times, and I had to do some like retroactive, diplomacy and transparency
at home.
Yeah,
they're like, what's going on? Oh, let's talk about that. So you get written about,
yeah,
and then do you share the article, or do they see it on their own and they call and they're like, what's going on with this play, or what happened, or is this about me, or how did that work?
Yeah, basically, yeah, the review coming out. Yeah. I mean, I had told them that it was happening, and I had told them that I was inspired by them for the play, but some of the details, maybe, I don't know. I learned from that whole experience that in the future, if I'm writing about someone, you know, to just show it to them in advance and make sure.
Just give them a copy of it, have them read it.
Yeah, yeah, because that can also, you know, that can also just lead to some really beautiful conversations, and it can really deepen the relationship, but also it can make the work better, mm-hmm, because you're, you know, if you have their blessing to write this thing, you just understand it on a whole new level. But it's very complicated, mm-hmm, and it's, you know, it really wore me down in a lot of ways, and I kind of resolved to not do as much of that, at least in the near future. try to just make more stuff up.
yeah. So speaking of the ideas, I every playwright I have on, I always ask them this question, which is, where do the ideas, or like the origin of an idea, or the origin of a story, or whatever the story is about, the spark to that leads to the, you know, whatever the end up the final product is. Where does that come from? Do you start with an idea? Does it start from a character and then you work out from that character? Where do the ideas sort of come from?
Yeah, I mean, the actual spark, I mean, it's interesting. That word is interesting. I'm just thinking right now because even like when you're making fire, you know, even if it's like with flint and stone or whatever, those are materials that already exist. Like whatever you're actually making the fire with, like something has been formed and it's creating friction with this other thing that then creates that spark. And so usually when I get an idea that starts to really form, it's because this one thing I've been interested in for years suddenly, you know, has friction with this new thing, and those two very different materials coming together create, like, you can just start seeing it. I think, so for me, there's like lots of, there's themes that are of interest to me. There's specific places, you know, there's just like feelings, there's character traits, there's like news stories. It can be anything. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of like shelve it away. And there's like hundreds and hundreds of those things working in my imagination all the time. And then, yeah. And then for me, it's usually like being able to suddenly visualize how a piece like breathes, like how it moves. So usually it has something to do with like a relationship to time. I don't know if that makes sense, but like some, like a, there's lots of ideas. There's lots of like Flintstones or whatever.
Yeah.
But the spark itself usually comes from being able to suddenly, it's like you just take a breath and you can just see the whole, you can just like kind of intuit the rhythm of the piece suddenly, even though you don't know all the details, you don't know how it gets from point A to point B.
You can just so like, rhythm happens just for like, you.
Yeah, it's rhythm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, obviously that's clear in Plano, the rhythm of it.
Yeah.
But what was the first play that you wrote that kind of jump-started your career, that first got the most, was it Wheelchair, or was that your first published play, or was there something before that?
Wheelchair was my first published play, but that was sort of a really interesting, beautiful thing where that was just a one night only performance that we did at Dixon Place. You know,
it's sold out everywhere, by the way. Can't get hands on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, so crazy. I couldn't find it anywhere.
Oh, cool. I think there might be like a, that's good to know.
I couldn't find it anywhere. I went to John Wick, so I'm like, Wheelchair sold out. That's amazing.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that was so cool because that was a new press that was getting started by Rachel Cotter Nailbuff, and she was like, I want to publish up very unusual plays, you know, that are unusually formatted and just that wouldn't normally get published. And I really want to, you know, I want to have them read on the page like they're meant to be read, like not plugged into the same old Samuel French formatting.
Where did the idea for it come from? It's a Hasidic Jewish man in East Williamsburg, who's about to get evicted.
Yeah.
Did you know of an incident that was happening or somehow like personally that sparked that, or?
So that it came out, he's not Hasidic. He grew up Orthodox. Mm. It came from meeting this actor named Matthew Jaffe, who has this condition called Mobius syndrome. And he had acted in some work by Ping Chong. And so I had researched that and watched some video of him and just found him immensely compelling. And I got lunch with him and just got to know him a bit. And I cast him in a short film that I was making at that time. And then I was like, yeah, I just love this guy. Like, I was like, would you ever be interested in like acting in a full length piece? And initially we were going to try to do like a longer run. And he has a full-time job. He's on staff at LaGuardia College in Queens. And just the schedule was difficult for him. And so we just did one night only at Dixon Place. And it sort of collided with this other idea that I'd had about furniture talking. And somehow those two things just met, and that's where it came from. So I used some details from his life. The eviction part of it, I think, maybe came a little bit more out of like these furniture pieces, you know, like really like shitty furniture pieces, like a card table or like a broken fan, a broken chair, you know, like a mini fridge. Just these objects that, I don't know, just your eyes glaze over them. I just was drawn to them at that moment in time. Yeah. And that's where it came from. And I was so, you know, it was a beautiful night and I was really happy. I directed it myself with somebody else. But like getting that email about like publishing it, I was like, oh my God, like that was actually, it was a huge moment for me because it felt like out of nowhere and was just so, such a welcome surprise. Yeah. And then, but that play, you know, no one's really, not that many people have read it. No one really like wants to produce it. It's made for this very specific man, you know? And Yeah. So the first play that actually really started to like get some sort of like industry attention was actually Evanston Salt Cost Climbing, which didn't get produced in New York until last year. But that was the first one that had like, you know, a workshop at the Ojai Playwrights Conference. The first time I'd been sort of like picked out of the slush pile and given like kind of, you know, more like professional seeming opportunity and wasn't like self-initiating it. So that it was actually that play. And I was sort of writing Plano, Evanston and Heroes all at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. I was writing a ton of stuff. You know, you're just like writing. I was just writing everything, just trying to make something happen. Yeah.
All three at the same time.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Mm. And how, so when you're writing a play, how when you're writing anything, how many ideas do you throw away before you're like, all right, I think I got it now? Is there ever like, do you ever come up with that? I'm sure you do. You must write all the time. I'm sure there's like things you come with and you're like, you know what? I don't even like this. Let me throw this away or whatever. What's the process like?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's, yeah, I think I did like a... I did a masterclass at Playwrights Horizons once during COVID that was on Zoom. And so I was able to screen share and I showed everyone like my play folder. And so they could see how many like unfinished or discarded plays there were, because there are so many. Like, yeah.
Wow.
So many beginnings, you know, like so many things that I wrote the, you know, entirety of, and even might have workshopped a little bit. And just decided, you know, this isn't the one. It's not really representative of who I really am or what I really want to put out there. Mm-hmm. You know, because yeah, I mean, you know, you go through so many, you go through phases in life, and and especially when you haven't quite like made it yet, it gets really tempting to go down a certain road that feels like it's more marketable or like more edgy or more stylish or something.
Yes. Yes.
And so you like try out a voice, but if it's not the authentic one, it's never going to be the one that people gravitate towards. So I see all those as like,
how do you catch yourself? How do you catch yourself going down that road of, and then saying, you know what, that's not authentic?
It's hard. I mean, it's just a gut feeling, you know, like for me, what I'm always looking for is that feeling of, you know, that it's like that, you know, when you like, when you're honest about something that you've maybe been dishonest about before, and it's uncomfortable and it's painful, but it's also a relief. Mm-hmm. Like it's that kind of uncomfortable relief that I'm looking for when I'm sitting there experiencing my own work. It needs to feel honest. And I, you know, if I feel that it's lying, then, you know, I know it. And so it's just about like admitting that to myself. And I've, you know, I've gone through whole, like there was a whole production of a play of mine in LA that happened before anything happened in New York. And part of it was that I couldn't really be involved. It was like they didn't have enough money to fly me out there and be really involved with it. And so I was long distance. And then when I saw it, you know, it wasn't really what I envisioned. And that was like upsetting in its own way. But I also, at the root of it, felt like this whole play is bullshit. Like this isn't
Which do you want to say? Was it? It's not a published play, or is it?
No, it's not published.
Oh, do you mind saying what it? Or do you don't want to?
Yeah, it's called The Mongoose. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And there was some cool shit in it, but just stylistically, like on the level of like the way the scenes are constructed, the way the lines are written, just at a microscopic detail. When you zoom out, there's some cool ideas, but it's not coming from. I can just see the impulse. It's.
Was it reaching? Were you reaching, you think?
Yeah, I was absolutely reaching. Yeah. I was trying to be something that I wasn't. I was trying to, I was thinking more about the audience than I was thinking about truth or something. You know, it was a little bit of a, it just wasn't, it wasn't the real thing.
It's good to catch it though.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't catch it. That's wonderful. The next play, Plano, was after that?
Yeah.
I just finished reading this morning, actually. It's fascinating. And it's fascinating to read it. And then I was actually telling Orlando, because I watched clips of it. And it's so different when you read it and you watch clips and you see it done and done so well.
Wait, yeah, where were the clips?
There was one or two, I think there's only one or two clips online from the actual production when the three sisters are sitting outside on the porch.
Yeah, like a little trailer kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes,
yeah.
And she's talking about, I think it was when Anne is telling them that she, Anne's telling them that she met John or Juan, and they have that little moment, and then Juan comes on stage for a moment, and then he leaves. I mean, it's hilarious when you see it there, but it's you can't envision it when you read it. Mm. It's crazy. The absence of time. That idea is fascinating to me. What made you come up with? If people haven't read it, or if you don't know what we're talking about in the play, time doesn't really exist. Really. I mean, I felt like time was kind of not even a variable. It was just time passed within a sentence. It's later. They mm-hmm. keep saying it's later. Mm-hmm. A character will say it's later and it jumps to that moment in time. Mm-hmm. And then now I kind of understand when you were talking earlier about the rhythm and the timing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What made you want to do that in this play and use the characters to jump time like that?
Yeah, I mean, it just came out of a feeling, the feeling of you know, maybe this is unique to being in a big family, but I don't think so, because you know we all have, you know, a lot of us have like a wide net of people who are part of our, you know, people, our community. And when multiple people that you care about a lot are going through something painful and you're not in a position to solve it, like it's kind of their own thing to solve, but you care about them so much and don't want them to be in pain, mm-hmm. and it just seems like it's all happening at once, and one mm-hmm. person's maybe diminishing their own thing so that the other person's can take up more space, and one person's maybe not admitting, you know, the breadth of what's actually going on with her, you know, like anyway, it just came from the feeling of like being a brother to these sisters that I love and just being like, oh my God, everything's falling apart, you know?
Yeah. And it must have felt like everything was happening quickly, which is why that's probably what the idea for that came from.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it also felt like everything that was happening was kind of like really resonating with like our ancestry and our, you know, our past, like this like Sicilian history on my mom's side. And like, it just felt like, it felt cursed. Something, it was this like cursed summer, you know?
Yeah.
And so it felt like everything was happening all at once, not just now, but always, like everything, you know, everything everywhere all at once. Yeah. I wrote that first. Yeah, Daniel stole it from me. Just kidding. But there, you know, there is that line of like towards the end where Anne's like, I think everything happens all at once in a random hell, you know? And and Dallas can feel like a random hell at times when it's really going down.
There's something interesting that I actually wanted to read from here, which is the author's notes, which I've never really seen like this in depth before. Uh-huh. Do you mind if I read it real quick? Because I find it to be very fascinating. This play goes very fast. It lives or dies by its metronome. It should hover around 77 minutes. That being said, you should not sacrifice the story's clarity for speed's sake. It's a lot to take in, but let us try. There's a logic here, even if it's always just beyond our grasp. I love that, by the way. The key to clear storytelling here is the sisters having ownership over the mechanism of the play. Find actors who can fully embody the emotional life of the play while doing virtuosic hairpin turns. They are real people with papers to grade and children to feed and rosaries to pray, doing their best to find their way through this uncanny valley. The weirdness will do its own work. Don't play into it too much. And then the faceless ghost, which I want to ask you about. Mm-hmm. The faceless ghost should be on stage during pre-show. About him, he's a guy in contemporary clothing. He doesn't have a face. The faceless guy I dreamt about last night because I fell asleep reading this. And then I was telling Orlando what he wasn't faceless in my dream. He actually had a face, but he had no mouth. And he just looked like he was painted completely in white. Mm. Just like it looked like somebody took paintbrush and just painted him white. Mm. And he was standing there. And I think I tried to have a conversation with him, but he had no mouth, so he couldn't talk. Mm. But what is what? I can't figure it out. I can't figure out what the faceless guy is, what he means. There is some hinting towards a spiritual being in the play, God or something. But then there's also hints of him being bad. So does it have to do something with the sickness? Or I couldn't quite figure out whether it was good or bad. Is it something you even wish to? Do you want the audience to have their own idea of it, or was there something specific about the faceless man that he represents to you?
Well, on just like a basic level, you know, Genevieve has her male presence, which is Steve, and he keeps multiplying. So there's a second Steve, and then eventually a third Steve, and Anne has John Juan, who keeps disappearing, and he, you know, we get the sense later on that maybe he's also been multiplying, but that he's more skilled at managing it. Mm-hmm. and then Isabel has the faceless ghost, who in a way is kind of like a blank canvas that you can project a lot onto. But in a very real sense, in terms of like the logic of the play, he's her male presence. And
because the other characters have one and she doesn't. So that's her male presence.
Yeah. And in the same way, the other male presences multiply and warp, you know, the same could then be assumed about the faceless ghost, that he is also contains these like multiple, you know, and some of them are. Some of them are good and some of them are evil and some of them are weak and some of them are overpowering. And, you know, that there's just a lot there. And I think, you know, for me, yeah, it's not something that I would ever want to be clear that he represents God or he represents, you know, a string of boyfriends or he represents disease or there's so many things you could decide and it's deliberate that like none of them are quite aha, it's this. But you know, I think the experience of watching the play probably is more satisfying in terms of that question than reading it, because again, like watching it, you just mm-hmm. see, oh yeah, there's the third guy, that's her guy. And that's really fucked up. Like whatever's going on there, you know, like, man, at least the other ones can, you know, kind of wrap their heads around it. And poor Isabel, like, you know, he's kind of, beyond comprehension. So
yeah, when you first read the play, it appears to be about the women, but the play is very much about men, these men in their lives, which to me feel very ungrounded, very aloof. They come and go. It's almost very much like Chekhov in the sense that they don't connect. They're always missing each other, it feels like. You know, Stella Adler used to say the characters in Chekhov are, it's almost like they're always missing each other. They never really, you know, they never really connect. So they're always going above each other's heads. This felt like that to me with the men in the play. You know, you have Anne with John, who's really Juan, but wanted to be John. And, you know, it's always like, you know, they have separate rooms. They love each other. They're intellect. What did the mom say? He's your intellectual equal. Intellectual equal, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe intellectually they're equal, but I feel like emotionally they're always missing each other. Isabel has this faceless guy that they can't possibly connect intellectually. Also, he comes and goes. Steve multiplies. He's in Plano. He's gone. It just feels like they're always, the men are never grounded and there for them. And it feels very chaotic. It feels like their lives are chaotic. And this is just my interpretation, but it feels like the lives of the women are very chaotic because of the lack of presence or lack of consistent presence or lack of consistent emotional presence from these men. Is that accurate, my interpretation of it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I think that might give the men too much power. Like, oh, if they were only to just show up more and be here more, then everything would be okay. I think that, like, part of why it's so important that the entire, like, final act has to do with this sudden presence of their mom is that there's, like, a sort of, I'm trying to get at a deeper, more tragic kind of Medea-like cycle of, you know, what daughters are taught by their mothers about how to be with men and how to, So that's really like the cycle that they're trying to break. You know, there was like, you know, both years this play got reviewed by in the New York Times by the same person, and both times she was like, this play is really just all about the men, and that's so frustrating. And I felt, and I think a lot of people who saw it felt, that that just wasn't true. It's about it's very much about these women, and it's very much about their history together, like this curse that they're trying to like men are allowed to do all these things that the women aren't allowed to do in the confines of the play. That's the point. Like, the women have to stay on the porch, the men are somewhere else. But the curse that they're trying to, like, break, and this cycle that they're trying to make be a little bit better next time, is between them. You know, it's not really about the men. It's something else. That's what I was wrestling with. I also very much was wrestling with, like, being a man and, like, seeing my brother-in-law, like, become a different person. And, you know, this person that I was very close to, like, changing in this fundamental way that was very disturbing to me and very, like, horror-esque, you know? So that's why the play has these horror elements, because it felt like, you know, it felt like that. Anyway, I think your interpretation is good, and I think seeing it live would complicate it even further, because I think once the mom comes in and does what she does, like, it just is like, you know, it takes it to a new place.
The motherly love.
After
Plano came Heroes. Heroes of the Fourth Turning, incredible play, obviously won the Obie, nominated for the Pulitzer. What was it like hearing the news that you were nominated or even won the Obie? How incredible was that?
It was good. It was during, you know, real COVID. So I was just alone in my apartment for all of it.
That's so crazy.
So I would have to, like, record little acceptance speeches. Just like in my, you know,
I saw one of them. I think I saw your Obie acceptance speech.
Just like, I was probably, like, in PJs and but put on, like, a collared shirt with pajama bottoms. And, I mean, it was awesome. You know, it was, you know, anytime you make something, you're working so closely with people, and you're becoming very close to them. And so for me, the most moving part of that was that my entire team won an Obie. Like, all of the actors, the director, all of the designers, we all won an Obie together. Amazing. And that was just so cool. Because it just felt like we were all in it together, and we all had this, you know, we were just going for this really hard thing together. And so that was the most meaningful part of that.
The first time I actually was put onto your work was by Orlando. Actually, we do this thing called A Night of Scenes here in New York, where actors come in, they audition, just do scenes, and we put them up in a theater in front of an audience, and you know, it just gives actors an opportunity to get up and do some work. And Orlando did a scene from Heroes of the Fourth Turning, and it was amazing. Nice. Absolutely amazing. And I was shocked that I didn't know what the play was.
But what scene is it? What's right at the top with Kevin? Yeah.
It was so good. Yeah. It was so amazing. It was wonderful to, and it was funny because I was rereading it and I completely had forgotten that he had did it. I was like, oh my God, this is the scene that Orlando did. It was really, really great. The success of Heroes, I would say a shift in your work, in the kind of writing it is. Would you say Heroes is very different than Plano and all the other plays, in the sense of it's more realism. I don't know. Very much a piece about people just sitting around and talking about life. Obviously about it takes place during the Trump presidency, correct?
Yeah, 2017.
And what was the inspiration to write that?
That one was I was writing all these plays at the same time. So it was like each play, you know, I had no idea what the chronology was going to be when they were produced in, and if they were going to be produced at all. And so I was just trying to make them all like authentic to what the subject matter was. And in this case, you know, because it's about these classically educated people who would have read, you know, Aristotle, it felt like it had to be in conversation with like Aristotelian structure. Mm-hmm. And so then, because of the subject matter and because, you know, political plays, I think have a real, you know, place and long history in New York, it felt exciting to create a kind of Trojan horse of a play that, you know, looked and acted and sounded like plays that they were used to seeing, but then had not just the surprise of these conservative politics that kind of go unchecked in the play, but also structurally, I think it's a lot more elusive than it might seem on the surface. And there are also kind of supernatural things that are happening, mm-hmm. that are just weaved in with a much more like delicate touch. The restrictions were a lot tighter on this play. I couldn't write with quite as much abandon and freedom and just be like, you know, with Plano, it could be like, yeah, why not? You know, this, you know, but this was, I had to experiment in this other form. And it wasn't as fun, you know, it was harder.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was harder. Yeah. I was more miserable. Yeah. Yeah.
I do a little bit of writing, and whenever I sit down to try to write, it's like torture to me. It is a daunting task to sit down and actually get into and start writing and writing and writing. Do you enjoy the act of? I know a lot of writers that don't actually enjoy writing, but they feel like they have to do it. What's your feeling about it?
I basically any emotion you can feel. I felt towards writing. So there's no definitive one way I felt towards writing. I've been, you know, I've been like passionately in love with it, and I've been, you know, homicidal towards it. So that might be categorized as a toxic relationship. I don't know. But it depends. It depends on what's going on in my life. It depends on how tired I am, you know, from other projects. It depends on the subject matter, what I'm writing about, how easily it's flowing. You know, sometimes with Plano, it just flew out. It was like, just tell the truth about this thing and like use whatever theatrical tools you have at your disposal to get it right. And with Heroes, it was like, okay, you're playing in this very, very small sandbox, and it's about a subject matter that is not easy and is not really to my taste normally. Like, I'm much weirder than this kind of play. And so, but I felt like this weird responsibility to do it. I felt like in this way, I was like, I'm the only one who can write this play. So I have to write this play, and now's the time to write it. God damn it, I have to do it. Yeah. You know? And so, So it was much, you know, there were times when it flowed and that, you know, especially when you just get into the characters and just like the realness, like it's not unenjoyable to write naturalism. It's fun to, you know, think about what a person's body is going through over the course of an evening, like especially if they're drinking or if they're in chronic pain or, you know, they're doing cocaine or, you know, whatever it is. Like it's, that stuff is all fun, but weaving that together with debate and, you know, these sort of, yeah, structure and these larger things, especially when you don't know how it's going to be received. Like, you know, it's a really tricky subject matter. So all of that was just like stressful and exhausting. And yeah, and I just like, you know, a lot of back and forth in my mind about whether it was even worth doing at all.
It was. It's an incredible play.
Thank you.
Love it. What's the noise? The noise that keeps happening. What was that? You're like, I'm not telling you. You got to figure that out.
No, I don't know what it is. We don't know what it is.
You're like, oh, you just, when you were writing, it just, you were like, something is making noise somewhere that takes him away from the, was it a mechanism to get out of the, get him out of the conversation for a minute?
No, not at all.
No?
No, it just showed up. It showed up from like the depths of my soul. It was just like, it's sort of like that, what I'm describing about the experience writing this play and how difficult it could be. Every once in a while, this sort of like primal scream would just show up. Mm. But yeah, the scream wasn't, you know, I just tried to listen to it like the arrival of a new character, sort of like with Faceless Ghosts. It just sort of showed up in this intuitive kind of dreamlike way. The sound showed up. It felt very confident. You know, I think I was just like writing in the flow, and then suddenly I was like, you know, pressing tab 6 times and being like, suddenly there's a loud noise, you know, it just flowed out of me. And I was like, oh shit, you know, yeah, what is that? And then I just could never, really answer that. But it felt like a fact, you know?
I love that even more that there's a definitive answer. And I think because as somebody that's trying to write more, trying to learn how to be a better writer, I always feel like I have to explain everything, or there has to be some sort of meaning, specific meaning behind something. And it's just, I think, very comforting to know that if you feel something and you feel like if it's talking to you, it doesn't really have to make specific sense.
Yeah.
And it'll work.
Yeah.
You know, it can work, and you should not be afraid to explore those things. I feel like we're always like trying to play within the confines of the rules or, you know, play by, you know, nobody does that, or that doesn't make any sense, or whatever it may be. And just to not be afraid, just to go for it.
Totally. Yeah. And just listen closely, to what, you know, there is something sort of spooky that happens, like a sort of, I don't know quite the words, but it's like you can really transport yourself into the world of the thing that you're writing about. And you can really feel like you're in that space with those people. And so that means that you're listening not just to the things that they're saying, but also like the sounds, you know, the sounds of the night, the sounds of the environment, like, you know, there's something meditative about it. You can hear like the people outside on the street right now, or like the hum of the electricity, or, you know, like any little thing becomes part of it the deeper in you go. And, you know, if a primal scream shows up, yeah, you might be able to psychoanalyze it and be like, oh, he was just getting tired of these people talking. But that could also be like, oh no, in that space at that time there's this scream, and it's like a little bit of a machine, and it's a little bit of an animal in pain, and that's what it sounds like. And so now it's a part of this, and what does that do to this, you know? And I think, you know, I'm someone who believes in, there's a lot that there's so much that we don't know about the universe and the earth, the universe all around us. And there are things that happen that are unexplained. And, you know, there was one time that we were workshopping this play in Cape Cod, and we were doing these talkbacks after these public readings. And someone was literally asking the question, what is the generator? And I was sort of giving a version of this answer, like, I don't know. And they were really unsatisfied with that answer. And then there just was an insane sound in the room. There was like, it was like a air conditioner, like freaking out or something. But it just happened while we were talking about it. And it was really loud and everyone jumped. And I was like, that's the sound, you know?
Yeah.
And just because he can't source it doesn't mean that it doesn't have a source. But anyway. Yeah.
Incredible. Let's talk a little bit about making a transition to television. I mean, you're doing so incredibly well in the theater world. I'm sure people are waiting for you to write another play. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that. But how did Succession, the biggest show in the world right now, incredible show, how did that opportunity come from, being a playwright and then all of a sudden working on such an enormous show? Also, I'm a bit unclear it's a bit unclear online as to what specifically your role is with Succession. You're listed as a co-producer. Orlando said you were the story editor. What exactly is your position there?
I was a writer on the staff. Like, I was in the writer's room, basically.
Okay.
I was never a story editor. I mean, those titles are just sort of like hierarchical Hollywood way of designating it's just confusing because there are mm-hmm. writers who are listed with the same producer title that actual producers are listed as. You know, there's like executive producers, and some of those are like just like the top level writers in the room, like the people who have worked with Jesse the longest and been the show the longest and have the, you know, the contract to reflect like their level of experience and their depth of engagement with the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes sort of like down from there, like co-executive producer, like, I don't know the order, like consulting producer, supervising producer, co-producer, producer, story editor, staff writer, you know, like they're sort of contract terms.
Got
to
it.
Sort of keep that stuff in line. And,
but you were involved in writing episodes, coming up with ideas for storylines, being in the writer's room, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. So I was there. Yeah. I was there for the season 4 writer's room, and then for season 3 I was in the writer's room for a month and didn't do any actual writing. I was consulting, I was giving notes on scripts and stuff.
Nice.
So I had that was like an executive consultant credit. And then for this one I co-wrote episode 6 and was just there for 4 months in the writer's room in London.
How was that?
Breaking story.
Was that cool?
Yeah, it was really cool. Yeah, it was really cool.
Was it I don't know. What was the experience? Was it very different than anything else you'd ever done?
Yes, it was. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I just wanted to learn from Jesse. I my admiration for him.
Just nominated for an Emmy, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
the show got like 24 or something. 27.
Yeah.
Jesus. God. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant man and also just a good man. And so I just wanted to be around him and see not only how he constructs story, but also how he runs a room and how he treats his collaborators. And he does it all with incredible grace and dexterity and generosity and humor. And so I'm going to be learning from him and like going back and replaying things from that experience for the rest of my life. He's really, there's a reason. The reason the show is so good is, in my opinion, not just that he's a genius, but also a good person, and the way that he treats the writers in that room and how closely he listens to the ideas that everyone's bringing in, and also just the kinds of people that he's gathering together. And mm-hmm. it was a really cool mix of like veteran comedy writers and playwrights and Yeah. And it was fun. It was hard. It was exhausting. It was a day job, you know. It was like showing up and, you know, getting there in the morning and turning my brain on and talking with a bunch of brilliant people about each episode and scene in the show. So, yeah.
And I feel like HBO is one of the only networks that really values people from theater, because a lot of their actors in a lot of Boardwalk Empire was filled with theater actors. Mm-hmm. You know, Sopranos had some incredible cast, a lot of other theater actors in that show. And now, you know, finding out, like, by the way, how did you get the call to how did you even get, how were you offered the job? Did you have to, is there an audition for writers? I don't even know.
No. How that yeah. No, it's just, it would just be Jesse deciding who he wants in that room. And so he was.
Did you know him before, Jesse? Or?
No, not at all. I mean, I was a big fan of the show. And then with season three, the writer's room sort of coincided with Heroes going up in New York. And I think a few of the writers were able to see it before they went over to London. And then also Frank Rich, who's one of the producers on it, saw it. And then I had a meeting with him about trying to find like a TV project together. And I was like, I've never had an experience in a writer's room. Like, I would really love that. And he was like, you know, let me send your play to Jesse. And then Jesse read it and liked the play and was like, yeah, let's bring this guy on. Especially because there was some political stuff starting to really happen in season three with the Mencken character and everything. So yeah, I sort of jumped on then and was so happy when they invited me back for season four in this like fuller capacity. Yeah. And I obviously like got to know Jesse in between season three and season four. I started working on my own pilot that he gave me some great thoughts on. And so it was just this developing relationship. Yeah.
And do you feel, you know, I talk about this with a lot of actors now. Back in the day, you know, actors used to come up from the theater and then go to film and TV. There was a real pipeline. You know, producers would come and they would see you in an off-Broadway play, and you know, for example, John Cazale, you know, was seen in a Broadway play and then brought in, you know, for The Godfather or whatever it may be, and you know, ended up playing Fredo. I feel like it's become the opposite for acting now. You have to go on and become famous, and then you can come to Broadway, because it's such a thing. You have to sell tickets, and it's almost like they can't sell tickets unless there's huge names involved. So it feels like the pipeline is opposite now for actors.
Yeah.
It feels like you got to go on, build a film and television career, become huge, and then they can bring you to Broadway so that they can sell tickets. It feels like that's not the same with writing. It feels like there's still a pipeline. Or was there always a pipeline like this for playwrights? Or is this a new thing? Or is this just an HBO thing?
I mean, I think there was always a pipeline to a degree. I mean, I think once the streaming boom really happened, there was even more of an open pipeline. And there were just more, you know, there were so many shows. And so there were so many more opportunities. But yeah, I think it's all dramatic writing, and Hollywood is always looking for people who can really write dialogue. And so, you know, I think that's been happening for a long time. Yeah. I think the two sort of go hand in hand personally. I mean, if you love both, I know like the theater here, the people who, you know, run theaters here are always worried that everyone leaves for the TV, but I think like sustaining a love for both,
I agree,
is really possible.
Well, I know that you have some deals with A24. I was reading about, which is, you know, a wonderful studio putting out really incredible work. Do you want to talk about any of the upcoming projects you have, or anything we can look out for that you're excited about that we know that's coming up? Can you talk about anything?
Oh, I mean, things are always changing. I mean, you know, there's a strike.
everything on hold. I mean, I'm sure everything is on hold. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always like, the thing I was working on with A24 was, yeah, that was for like 2 years. And then you know, by the time we were really taking out the show and trying to, like, you know, it was in the best position it could be in.
It was a TV show, not a film?
Yeah, it was a TV show. Okay. Yeah. And I have another like film thing going with them too. But yeah, it just, by the time we were taking it out, we had an awesome director attached. That was like right after Netflix reported its first quarterly loss. And then Zaslav took over HBO and everyone was just freaking out and people were getting fired left and right. So we were pitching to like, we ended up only pitching to like two places and they were just like, it was a show about like conservatives in New York. Like, they were like, we just can't do this. And so it just kind of, you know, things that seem like they have incredible momentum suddenly just fizzle away.
That sucks.
And,
yeah,
but like, there was a point during the pandemic where I was like juggling 10 projects between film, TV, and theater. And, you know, eventually, like last year, like Succession and then Corsicana and Evanston, the two plays they did last year, they were all part of that. And those mm-hmm. came to fruition and those happened. And that mm-hmm. always feels good when they happen. And, you know, you can move on. But like, there's other ones that I'm just like still burning a candle for, like, mm-hmm. come on, we can get you across the finish line somehow. But it's mm-hmm.
other plays or the TV shows?
A couple plays, but yeah, mostly like these TV, like,
oh,
TV
have,
and
you
film
have new
projects.
Plays you've written?
Well, there's plays that I've, yeah, there's like one play in particular that I've written that I'm trying to get going. It's a really wild play. So I don't know, you know, we'll see, but yeah, these like film projects that I've been working on for a long time, that there just keeps being these disruptions with the pandemic and now the strike. So we'll see. It'll be a while. But I'm patient.
Yeah. Where do you see the strike going? Do you think it's going to be the writer's strike specifically? Do you think it's going to be a long drawn out thing? Do you think do you have any insight into exactly what's going on or what the?
I mean, all I know is that that it couldn't be coming at a better time. I think both unions have sort of stumbled into a historical moment. What I mean when it couldn't be happening at a better time is that, like, I do think AI is a real threat to not just our industry, but 100%. Industries across the globe. And like, a lot of people in like the business sector treat that like it's just like an inevitability that it's, you know, it's going in this direction. There's nothing we can do about it. But I do think, we're human beings. And if we don't carve out, like, we can actually change the course of history, even if it's in a small way, or if it's like carving out these predictions, or just like, you know, coming together and telling a story that's more powerful than that quote unquote inevitable change, and just like taking a bet on ourselves and just like saying, hey, we prefer this, we prefer mm-hmm. doing this ourselves yeah. as like a society. I don't know, like maybe some real protections can be carved out. I like in 1960, I think it took like over 160 days when the actors and the writers struck together. So we might be in it for the long haul, mm-hmm. Especially because it's really like unknown territory. Like, again, nobody.
It feels like we're so far apart too. The way yeah. Fran Drescher is putting it, she's just like, I can't believe it almost seems like they're mountains apart on yeah. on the issues, which is yeah. bizarre.
Yeah, yeah, truly. I mean, yeah, it's super disturbing and dispiriting to see the ways that they talk about us. Yeah, but, you know, thank God it's happening. I mean,
yes,
otherwise
I agree,
we would maybe just like have our heads in the sand or be sort of like mildly dissatisfied and sort of taking that all out on ourselves, you know, like, what am I not doing? How am I not playing the game right? Yes. You know, there's so much yes. like emotional and like private emotional turmoil that all of us had as we try to navigate this industry. And now it's like, oh no, we've all been feeling this, haven't we? Like, we're able to see each other now. And so no matter what happens, at least like that sort of like vertical relationship that we all had with like the studios, you know, like the people who make the decisions has been disrupted. And we are like actually like present and looking around at each other and being like, oh yeah, this is fucked up and has been for a while, isn't it? Like, you know, so
we can see each other now. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it feels like, yeah, I feel it. I feel we feel united, you know, for the first time. It's almost like we feel each other's pain and,
yeah.
And we have to do something about it because yeah. It's crazy. I mean, the idea to scan a background worker's face,
yeah.
Pay them for a day of work and then use their likeness in perpetuity. I mean, that's the most insane thing I've ever heard in my life. I can't even believe they would suggest such a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I did background work for 5 years when I was a teenager. I yeah. loved it. You know, I loved being on set. I loved getting up in the morning, going to set, seeing the actors, going to craft service, standing around, you know, getting my little moment to walk across. And then, you know, just telling everybody that I got to work on these shows. I always enjoyed it. I always thought it was wonderful. And, you know, it's work. It's work for people. It's a paycheck. And it's how a lot of actors get their start.
Yeah.
It's how a lot of us figure out, you know, the lingo on set.
Yeah, totally.
Sound speed. Yeah. You never know what any of this stuff is until yeah. you actually get on a set and extra work is where you learn that stuff, is where you learn a lot of that stuff.
Totally.
So I hope we're able to come together. Well, I hope during this time off that we all have, you write more stuff and bring a lot of more exciting stuff for us. Cause, you know, I love your work. It's incredible. I can't wait to see your next play and hopefully we get a chance to do that soon.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
And, thank you so much for coming here, man.
Thank
it was
you.
A wonderful conversation and, I really appreciate you giving us your time.
Thank you. Thank yeah. you. I appreciate you listening to whatever I had to say. Who knows?